It's time now for the Perspectives on the Power of We, presented in partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee and the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. Host Ron Harris and Warren E. Logan Jr., WMPZ Groove 93, Harrison, Chattanooga, a Brewer Media station.
The following is a paid program. The views and opinions expressed by today's guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee, the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga, or any of its employees and the Brewer Media Group.
Hello, Chattanooga. This is Donna L., and I am so excited that you are joining us today for another episode of Perspectives on the Power of We, a special limited series sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Chattanooga. I have none other than Mr. Ron Harris, Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you again, Donna.
Hey, I'm happy you're here. And we got to say, this segment is, it's a special edition, but it's powerful and mighty. And today we're missing your co-host, which is Mr. Warren Logan, but he has other commitments, and we miss him.
He did, and I'm going to chastise him for that because I miss him. Look forward to the next episode.
All right, sounds good to me. Now, the last 2 months, your program has really been focusing on voting. I just love that, the power of the vote. The U.S. had record turnout for the presidential election a few weeks ago. Now, what are your thoughts on that, and how do we keep the momentum for local elections like the Chattanooga mayoral race? Because this is the time people need to get involved.
It was absolutely amazing to watch that at the national level. Record-setting turnout. It was great. However, it's more important, or at least equally important, that we have record-setting turnout at the local level. Mm-hmm. That's where we're impacted the most. That's where the rubber meets the road. Our economic development, our continued community growth, our education at the local level comes through our vote, and it's powerful. We got to keep it going. We're going to keep talking about it.
Oh, definitely. It was so many people that showed up at the polls, and I never thought I would see that in my lifetime. It's absolutely amazing, and I just believe that for our city as well.
I hope you're right. Democracy works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it only works when we vote.
That's right. That's right. Now, we're going to shift gears just a little bit about this episode and kind of talk about Kerry Hayes. He's actually going to talk to you. He's a chief of staff to Mayor Andy Burke, and he's going to have a conversation about Mayor's Council Against Hate and a panel of business and community leaders to discuss the difference between being a non-racist and an anti-racist. This is a concept discussed in Ibram X. Kendi's book called How to Be an Anti-Racist. So you're going to have panelists, let's say, from like Scott Wilson, VP of Corporate Communications and Community Relations for Blue Cross, James McKissick, my friend, President and CEO of Artsville, and also Keitha Richardson, right, from EPB. What is his title, by the way?
Keitha's title is Director of Inclusion and Diversity at EPB. Looking forward to having all three of them. Right. Outstanding community leaders.
Right. What are you excited about with this conversation? Like, what are you looking forward to the most about having this conversation?
Well, I think one of the things that's most exciting about it, the first thing is that we're having it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because this is a conversation that doesn't take place, and we're having this conversation in Chattanooga, and we're going to talk not only about racism, but we're going to talk about being non-racist versus, if you will, being anti-racist. Mm-hmm. There's a difference.
Right.
And so we're looking forward to a robust and energetic discussion around that differences and the things that we can do to be non-racist.
I love that. Now, I want to thank you again for joining me, and we'll be right back to continue the Perspectives on the Power of We, and just thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
All right.
It's always a pleasure.
Most definitely. And when we return, Ron will sit down with Kerry Hayes to talk about his work with the Mayor's Council Against Hate. We'll be right back after this.
Now back to Perspectives on the Power of We with your host, Ron Harris and Warren E. Logan Jr., only on Groove 93.
Hello and welcome back to the Perspectives on the Power of We. I'm Ronald Harris, Vice President of Corporate Workforce Diversity at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. And unfortunately, I'm not joined by our co-host, Warren Logan, of the Urban League. He did have a prior engagement, so we look forward to him being with us on next month. The Power of We is presented by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. And this morning we're joined by Kerry Hayes. He's the chief of staff for Mayor Andy Burke, and Kerry oversees the Mayor's Council Against Hate. Very important council. Great to have you with us today, Kerry.
Thanks very much, Ron. It's my pleasure.
Welcome. Listen, why don't we just jump right into the questions, if you don't mind?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, so can you start off by telling us a little bit about the council, when it was established, and what is its purpose?
Yeah, the Council Against Hate is a project that Mayor Burke first announced in 2018, actually, at his State of the City address that year. And it has its roots, actually, in the community's response to the July 16th attacks from several years prior to that. Just a terrible moment for the community, and one that obviously changed changed his life and changed the city forever. The response to that attack, which, as you recall, involved an attacker who was Islamic, took the lives of five American servicemen. The response to that it was very important to the mayor at that time that that be handled in a way that did not further radicalize other members of our community. And at the time, there was a lot of conversation within the mayor's office and within the community about the true goals of terrorism are obviously to commit acts of violence and to take lives. A larger goal is to create other terrorists. It is to produce fear and anger and division within a community such that it collapses on itself. That was something that Mayor Burke was absolutely resolute was not going to happen in Chattanooga. And if you look back at the coverage of that time, feels like quite a long time ago. It was just 5 years ago or a little more than. Everything that the city did to try to move forward from that attack was handled in a very intentionally interfaith way. It was very inclusive. It included members of our Muslim population, included other faiths, standing side by side, making sure that they were committed together to a message of peace and unity and collaboration and community that would not allow those divisive cracks to emerge. And so that spirit carried forward into the mayor's involvement with some other groups that had also been recovering from domestic terrorist attacks. And out of that, he realized that if we really wanted to see that work thrive and continue to the next level, we just needed to keep being intentional about it. So out of all that, the idea for a Council Against Hate was born. We passed around several different names trying to sort of figure out what to call this thing, but the idea essentially was to try to sort of build an organization that would do a lot of programming and a lot of thoughtful work to talk to a lot of different constituencies in our community about the need for inclusiveness, for peace, for collaboration, and to do so with an eye towards making sure that those marginalized communities and those populations in our city that may be particularly vulnerable to violence and bias-motivated crimes, we call them, had some resources to protect themselves. So the council had its origins, as I said, in the spring of 2018. We spent about a year building it, recruiting people into the steering committee, trying to sort of figure out some different ways that we could structure it. Formally launched to the community the following year in 2019, and at least prior to the pandemic, we've had some slowdown because of the coronavirus pandemic, but over the course of 2019 and into 2020, was doing just a tremendous amount of programming. I recall that you were involved in one of our panel discussions in Startup Week, I think, of last year, talking about diversity among the entrepreneurship community, and we're really grateful for your involvement in that program.
Well, we're grateful to the mayor as well as you for your leadership. This is a worthwhile venture, and you'll never cross the goalpost, cross the goal line. But I think it's something that we just need to continue to do. Listen, how can community members become more involved in the council's work? And you mentioned earlier about the pandemic, and I know we're quarantined or at least semi-quarantined right now, and that's impacted us all. But how can we become more involved as a community?
Well, yes, as you mentioned, so much of the council's work was built on in-person relationship building, interpersonal interaction. That was really the core and the key of what we were doing. We're trying to sort of bring diverse parts of our community together to exchange ideas and exchange some fellowship for a multitude of obvious reasons. It's very difficult as the pandemic now enters kind of another scary phase. Still asking for people to sign up, to join our email list, to affiliate themselves with the council. There's no application. There's no membership dues, you go to CHA.CITY, that's CHA.CITY/AgainstHate. That's our website. We'll take you to our website where you can find any number of things. There's a lot of resources on there, a lot of law enforcement resources, a lot of research and things that we've compiled from other parts of the country, and a sign-up form where people can deposit their information, and we will get them on our email list. That right now is the best thing we can ask people to do, is just to try to keep the membership strong. Let us know, let the city know, let the mayor know that people care about this issue, and they want to contribute.
Okay, good. Thank you. A couple of housekeeping questions, if you will. How often do you all meet, and what types of training or events do you hold?
Well, the trainings and the events covered by design covered a lot of different areas. We had within the council seven different, we called them action teams, but you could think of them as subcommittees, and each one was kind of meant to focus on a different part of the community. So we had a faith leaders group, we had a students and youth group, we had a teachers group, corporate community group. I was more closely involved with one that was speaking to members of the media and social media. So within each one of those groups, they were sort of responsible for their own programming, and they would do different events and different meetings all throughout the year. I don't know that there was a week that went by that didn't have some group or another meeting and doing something. For instance, there was the panel discussion that you were involved with during Startup Week. I remember around the same time, Wade Hinton from Unum then was with Unum, organized an event for the corporate community where people were meant to come and pledge their commitment to diverse and inclusive workplaces. We did some training specifically for Hamilton County school educators around the Holocaust and understanding how to teach that particular event as a way to educate our children about human rights abuses around the world. I did a panel discussion in conjunction with our local PRSA chapter where we brought together reporters from across the state, actually, to talk about how to cover or how they covered white supremacist gatherings and other things of that nature. Spent a lot of time interfacing with our local police department and the TBI and other law enforcement agencies to really understand from a legal perspective how these types of crimes and incidents are understood, how they're reported, how they can be prosecuted, and how we can bring justice to communities that may have been affected by bias-motivated violence. So that's a long, rambling answer, which is all to say that there was no particular schedule that I could point people to. It was a very active, very busy council, something that we continue to get just a tremendous amount of interest in. Sadly, as you recall, a couple of months ago, we had an incident on the Walnut Street Bridge where we saw some white supremacist graffiti, just a really painful reminder that these issues are still very much front and center in our community, and something that we have to stay vigilant around, even though we are not able to do as much as we would like until we kind of get the pandemic behind us, still very interested in making sure people understand that this resource is available.
Great. You know, that leads me directly into my next question. What are you and the council seeing in Chattanooga as far as racism and injustice are concerned, and what issues keep you up at night? What are your top of mind issues that you feel like need to be addressed in our community?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ron. I think we spend a lot of time concerned as we enter, we're approaching the ninth month of this pandemic, which is just hard to imagine. And if you had told me in the middle of March or middle of April that we would still be dealing with this in the cold months of the winter, I wouldn't have believed it. But we are, and I think that there's a lot of historical data that points to the idea that whenever a community or a country or society enters some prolonged period of trauma, be it a recession or something of this nature, those parts of the population that are already vulnerable are even more vulnerable to prejudice and to bias. And there's a tremendous amount of concern among, you know, religious minorities, ethnic minorities, other types of vulnerable populations, that they're even more prone to attack, prone to violence, prone to harassment. There's just an incredible amount of strain being placed on everyone right now, as you well know.
Yes.
Just a tremendous amount of trauma that we're all feeling and trying to sort of figure our way through, and that tends to show up in a lot of really ugly, divisive We see it online. We see comments online just proliferating, unfortunately, in the social media space, vilifying different religious groups, different ethnic groups, different racial groups. And that, unfortunately, does translate, sometimes comes off the screen and into real life, and people... as I mentioned, the graffiti incident on the bridge, I don't know if that was a couple of knuckleheads thinking that they were funny or if that was actually evidence of some neo-Nazi organizing in our community. I certainly hope that it's not, but those are the kind of things that keep us up at night. It's just the propensity for violence and the propensity for attacks, be they verbal or be they something more severe, on those parts of community that are already tend to be marginalized. That is very concerning, and that's the kind of thing that we worry that we can't really address as effectively as we would like while we're under the pandemic and while we're still trying to be as cautious with our movements and our gatherings and all those kinds of things for safety reasons.
Yeah, we've all got to stay vigilant, particularly in this area. What do you think is the future of the Council Against Hate, and where would you like to see it in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, as you may have heard, Mayor Burke is retiring from his position as mayor here in about 5 or 6 months. So middle of April, his successor will take office. Certainly, it's my hope, and I think the hope of the many dozens and hundreds of people that have been involved with the council, that this work continue in some shape, form, or fashion. I think, as I just mentioned, I think the need for it as we come into the next year and emerge from the pandemic, I think the need for a resource like this is going to be even more urgent. I really do hope that whoever the next mayor is will take this on as a project and remake it a little bit in his or her own image. But I think the idea, essentially, that people need a place and want a place to come together to talk and to exchange ideas and to do the kinds of really hardcore trainings that I mentioned, both for law enforcement, for educators, for members of the corporate community, so on and so forth. That's going to be, as you said at the beginning, we're not ever going to cross the goal line completely on this issue, but it's that progress and that continued push towards trying to make this the most diverse and inclusive and peaceful community that we can is something that I think really defines Chattanooga, and hopefully something that will continue under the next administration. So 5 years from now, if you were to ask me what success would look like, I think it would be a council against hate that continues to meet, continues to do things, that has grown in ranks, that has become more diverse, that welcomes people of all political affiliations, all religious and ethnic backgrounds under an umbrella of just a vision for the community that is as wide and inclusive as possible.
Well, it's certainly
How's that for an aspirational answer?
No, I think it was a great answer because, listen, I don't think this work should stop just because there's a transition in politics. I think this is so far beyond any particular administration. So I think the baton should be handed off. Nobody asked me, but I think the baton should be handed off to whoever leads the next administration. I think you're doing some work that needs to be done, and it needs to continue to be done until we get as close to that goal line as possible. In our next segment, I'm sorry, go on, Gary.
No, I just want to say I appreciate that very much. We appreciate so much the support the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundations has shown us in a multitude of ways, and all of it makes our city a safer place and a better place, and we're just grateful for y'all's partnership all the way through.
Well, we're grateful for the opportunity to be good corporate citizens, because the work you and so many others in the city do benefits us all. In our next segment, we'll be joined by a panel of community leaders to talk about the concept of anti-racism. So what do you think it means to be an anti-racist, and what do people need to do to be anti-racist in Chattanooga?
That's a fascinating topic, and I'm so grateful that y'all are engaging on that. That is something that actually the Council Against Hate did. That is our most recent program, and I should have mentioned at the outset, and she'll be cross with me for not mentioning. LaQuisha Ewing specifically led an anti-racism training for some of our membership. Terrific four-part program, a curriculum that she's built with some other facilitators in our community. Ron, I define that for I don't mind saying those of us in in the white community. It begins with acknowledgement that I hold myself an example of someone who has benefited from systems that predate me. It is a water that I swim in, that I don't know that I'm wet, that I understand that I have been given advantages and privileges and opportunities by dint of my race and my gender that I cannot take any credit for, and understanding that those systems exist and trying to see how and why they perpetuate themselves is, to me, the first little baby step that I can take to trying to dismantle some of these things. And if more folks, I think, want to take a little bit of time in their lives to reflect on those things, you try to sort of see the matrix, so to speak, for what it is, and understand that these structures can't take the blame for them, but I can certainly take responsibility for perpetuating them unless I'm cognizant and intentional about the ways that they give me advantages that they don't extend to everyone else in our community. That's justice is what fairness really is. As one of my favorite public defenders was paraphrasing Supreme Court justice one day told me, and that's I think that's at the core of anti-racist work, is that that recognition that fairness doesn't yet exist the way that it can, the way that it should, and willing to submit myself to the humility of recognizing that, I think is at least the first little step that we can take to trying to do some work in that space.
Well, you know, we're so grateful to you today for joining us, and I'm so thankful for the work that you and the council continue to do. Wish you much success in the future. And once again, on behalf of the Urban League, as well as Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee and the community at large, want to thank you for the work that you do. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kerry.
Thanks, Ron. You take care.
We'll return after a short commercial for a panel discussion on anti-racism.
You are now listening to the Perspectives on the Power of We with your host, Ron Harris and Warren E. Logan Jr., only on Groove 93.
Hello and welcome back to Perspectives on the Power of We. I'm Ronald Harris, and I serve as Vice President for Corporate Workforce Diversity at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. This program is presented by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. And my partner today is not with us, Warren Logan. He had a previous engagement, so we look forward to his return for our next episode. So we're joined by a group of community leaders to talk about the concept of being anti-racist. We have with us today Keith Richardson, Director of Inclusion and Diversity for the Electric Power Board, better known as EPB, and Scott Wilson, one of my colleagues, who serves as Vice President of Corporate Communication and Community Relations at Blue Cross, and none other than James McKissick, President of Art Bills. First of all, let's start with a little bit of background on the concept of anti-racism, if you don't mind. It's largely attributed to Ibram X. Kendi, author of the 2019 book on How to Be an Anti-Racist. The book asserts that the opposite of racist is not racist, and challenges all of us to think critically about how we as a society and culture can move beyond racism. The book gained media attention earlier this year following the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Have you all read it? If you have, and are you familiar with the concept Kendi introduces in it? James, I'll start with you.
I actually have read it. I listened to it as an audiobook, and I am familiar with the concept of non-racist versus anti-racist.
Ethan?
I have actually just picked the book up yesterday, but I have not read it yet, but I had that's on my thing to start this week. So, but I am familiar with the concepts, though.
And Scott, I know you and I've had a conversation or two about this subject. So have you read it as well?
I'm actually in the middle of it now. From a stack of books you recommended, I'm making my way through it. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
James, to understand what it means to be an anti-racist, you first have to understand what racism is. So how would you define racism?
Well, to me, racism is prejudice or discrimination directed at a person or a group of people based on their race or ethnicity. But what I always like to remind people is that racism is about systems. You know, it shows up in healthcare, education, voting, even the field that I work in and serve in, the arts. There are those individual acts of racism, and then there's systemic racism. And we must be anti-racist against both and not just try to be kind people.
Keith, I'm going to throw this one out to you and James. Have you ever experienced racism in or outside of the workplace? And if so, what was that experience like? Let's start with you, Keith.
Yeah, absolutely I have. As a child growing up, I've been experienced racism. I've been called the N-word. I've been profiled, you know, pulled over by the police before just because. I remember a particular incident when my brother's a year older than I am, and we were at school one day and we got all hyped up because the Boy Scouts, they were having like a Boy Scout thing where you can join the Boy Scouts, and they made it seem all really good with camping and all of that. So my mom took us to they had like a PTA meeting or something with and the Boy Scouts were going to be there. They're going to be presenting, and we were the only Black family that was there. And the way that they made my mom feel, or made all of us feel, we were just isolated. They weren't answering her questions. They kind of just ignored us as a group. And it made us, my mom was really upset about the whole thing. And, you know, we all felt that too. And it got her to the point where she actually went to the pastor of my church and she told him what had happened. And we ended up starting like a Boy Scout chapter, you know, through my church. And which was great. You know, it wasn't like we did the whole camping and things and everything like everybody did, but she wanted us to feel like, you know, a part of the group and everything. But I can tell you the way it made me feel though, when I hear people talk about the Boy Scouts and Eagle Scouts and they're all proudful and all of that stuff, I don't feel quite the same way about the Boy Scouts anymore that they will feel.
That's because of that experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
James, how about you?
Well, I could, you know, echo some of the things that Keith had talked about, especially, you know, growing up, being called racist slurs, being excluded, you know, and I think a lot of times we talk about those major acts of racism versus the microaggressions, like even now, just with us all wearing masks, you know, the looks, the feeling, the energy you get from people as you go around in a Black body masked up, or a large Black body especially. So I think a lot of those experiences we've all had. I think one thing that I try to do is, you know, accept that that happens. I've been on this planet for 48 years. And I love what Keith has said about, you know, moving on, creating your own, establishing your own welcoming institutions and organizations where you can feel that you have a place and a safe space.
And we'll come back to that, but let me reach out to Scott. Scott, you and I have been involved in the efforts to assist Blue Cross employees in navigating the complex issues and events that have occurred this year. You helped us launch an internal series called Critical Conversations. Can you talk about the purpose of the series and your experience with it? And why do you think it's so important for our employees to have this outlet?
I'll answer that in reverse. The reason it's important is what James just said, safe places, right? We want at Blue Cross, we don't just want to be, you know, we want when you come to work for you to feel embraced for you. And it's the difference between tolerance and embracing. And so let's face it, these incidents this spring and summer are just the most recent incidents, but somehow they were more impactful. And we felt that, and our employees expressed it. So we put a series of things in place, starting with Zoom calls with our CEO and yourself and we would just fill it up 150 people at a time and let people talk. It was important for the company to just listen, because those weren't fun, right? I mean, that was really hard to be a part of, but necessary. And we kept moving on. We started filming some videos where top executives told stories just like Keith and James just did. Coming to work in a suit and tie in a nice car, pulled over because they're looking for someone who looks like you. And by that, they meant black. And so, you know, these are really shocking things to hear. And so we started the critical conversations so that we could go from top down to where a team could watch a video together and then discuss it, so that we can keep this happening. And we also asked our employees, what can we do to make some changes at work to make you feel comfortable? And you're probably about to talk about some of those changes, so I won't steal your thunder, but it was important. Blue Cross can't fix the world, but we can address our workspace so that people are comfortable when they're at work. And I'm so proud that, you know, let's face it, the news cycle has moved on, but I'm really pleased that our company has not. And we continue to produce these opportunities for people to speak and express themselves on this topic and grow.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. You know, as a matter of fact, I saw a little sign the other day, and I did copy it and keep it. It says, you can change the world, but the first thing you have to do is change yourself. And so we're trying to just change that space where we are. Keith, here's a three-part question that I'll pose to you first. And if the other guys want to jump in, certainly they can. Does your organization have training programs in place to help employees understand and confront racism? And were you doing anything before the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor? And have you implemented anything new as a result?
Great questions. And I'm so glad Scott answered the way that he did, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. So the first question the answer to your question is that we've always had some training on in regards to diversity and inclusion through our compliance training. It wasn't to that degree, you know, of where it is now, but we've always had some training in those regards. And when the George Floyd incident happened and Breonna Taylor, our president David Wade had addressed some of the racial issues there with the company, the entire company, this summer. And as a result of some of that is, you know, Marie has gotten a promotion out of that to where she's has a focus on diversity and inclusion. And then I got a promotion out of it as well to where they created this position just so I can address these issues with the company, you know, kind of going forward. But we've always had employees working in this capacity. This is stuff that I was doing anyway in my previous function as the purchasing manager. And, you know, we had a lot of people that were doing that. Everything just became official. We just made it official after all the events that happened this summer. So, but, you know, it's something, though, that we faced in the, you know, just we just keep things that we face in the world today, and we just keep on going on with those things. But to go back to what Scott was talking about, we did something similar. We recorded some employees, and they were different from different levels of the company. And one had been there for 8 years, one had been there for 28 years, and one had been there for 45 years. And we recorded some of their stories and stuff, just like Scott is talking about. And some of these stories, it was just so powerful just to look at them and see the emotion coming out of these guys. And they're telling, you know, some of the things that happened to them. It was what we did the first time. We had a group of some managers. It was a diverse group of managers that we presented these stories. We let them look at the stories. And then we had a panel set up with David, Marie, and myself. And we kind of entertained some questions based on some comments and stuff that they made from the panel. And when I tell you, you had some people in there crying, you had men crying and women crying when they were looking at the pain and the hurt that these people that they see every day, but you would never know that based on how they carry themselves at work, you know, what they've been through. And like I said, that was so powerful for these guys. And some of them even said, you know, I've seen all of this stuff in the news and I see it and I know it's bad. But when I see some of my fellow coworkers that have experienced this, it hits you a different way. So that was very powerful. And I commend you guys for what you did. But and we were doing something similar to that as well. So and when you can share that and people can see these people, like I said, that they work with every day, it changes the game for them and it opened up some eyes.
Good, thank you. Also, congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you,
James.
Sir.
James, in order for people to really understand racism, it's important for them to know about its history and know about its complexity. How do you recommend people educate themselves on racism?
Well, I would say read everything about racism, about our country's history. One of my favorite recent publications has been the 1619 Project that the New York Times did a couple of years ago. And also search out films, music, visual art, all of these things have addressed racial equity in the past and in the present. And, you know, those are great tools. The arts are really great tools for studying racial issues in our country. Artists are really wonderful at pulling back that veil and letting us see what's really going on in society.
Scott, you know, so much racism isn't overt. It's not always in your face. There's a subtlety to it. So subtle acts of racism may be more difficult to detect, but they can be just as harmful. How do you think people can become more aware and stop these acts when they encounter them?
You know, thanks to you at Blue Cross, we now have a policy that is mandatory that everyone take unconscious bias training. And so I supervise two groups, corporate communications and community relations. And I went through that training with your staff, with both of those teams. And, you know, it's really eye-opening. These sort of microaggressions, they're so deep in our culture when it comes to race. And of course, it also applies to gender issues. There are similar things that men do at work that women have been putting up for a very long time. So talking through those things to make sure that, you know, you see yourself in the right context so that what you're saying is what you intend and not you basically just have to stop and listen, right? It was about listening to people and how they receive what you're saying.
You know, that was such a great comment, particularly around intent. Sometimes intent and results aren't the same. What you intended to happen didn't yield the result that you wanted. I'm so happy that you brought that up, because a lot of times people have great intention and bad results. And so you have to talk about it. You have to have those lines and channels of communication opened at all times. So Keitha, action is critical in being an anti-racist. In your opinion, what's the best way for people who want to be anti-racist to put their beliefs into action within our community?
Well, no, being an anti-racist is more than just reading yourself of the racist attitudes and beliefs and behaviors. You have to, you know, you have to actually fight the racism. You know, donating to organizations such as the Urban League that actually do things to actually fight racism. You know, look in your own circle. You know, if you're looking around and you see in your own circle that all you see is people that look like you, and you have no diversity within your own circle, you're not going to learn, or really understand what other people are going through. We encourage people to kind of get out and go to lunch with somebody that you may not necessarily go to lunch with. That's, you know, just so you can kind of get to know the people and learn a little bit more about it. That that ignorance, just not really understanding what's going on in people's lives and things like that, is huge. So just make that effort to go out and meet somebody and talk and actively fight against it. Like I was saying before, you had these guys that were crying. and they said they felt embarrassed and they felt angry at some of the stories that they heard of. And there are some things that you can do about it. You go out, like I said, you can make yourself go out and fight and go to these different websites and donate, get out and learn what's going on.
Okay. James, has there been a time when someone spoke out on your behalf or demonstrated that they were anti-racist? And if so, what did that mean to you when someone spoke up on your behalf?
This question is a little bit challenging to me because I really can't think of a time. And I think that that is a good thing because it means that when I have not been present or not in the room, that people have been bold and spoken up for me. And I think that that's something that's really important. Like when you're being anti-racist, the environment, the location, the time, the space should not matter. It should be that you are emboldened to speak up on behalf of people, for a people, and do and say what needs to be said in that right time, in that right moment. There's just don't do it for praise. Do it because it's right. And that we're not going to move forward as a society if we continue down the same paths that we're on.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is not enough. It's not enough to be non-racist. The next grand level is to be anti-racist. And that means speaking up and speaking out.
Go on. I loved what Scott said about the intent, and I know here in the a lot of time I've been studying the art sector, and people will say and make platitudes and have good intent about bringing more equity, more diversity into spaces, but intent without action is not anything. You know, intent without setting goals. Intent without defining what the expected outcome is. Those are the things that move you from being anti-racist, from being just non-racist to being anti-racist, putting the actions, the intent, the numbers behind it.
Yeah. Activity without accomplishment is just activity. So, Scott, in his book, Kendi makes the point that in order to be an anti-racist, one must stand against all forms of bigotry. In your opinion, why is standing against other types of bigotry so essential to standing against racism?
Yeah, I am far enough along in the book that he defines racism as a policy that creates inequitable outcomes for people of different skin colors, right? So it's a policy, and policies create atmospheres, right? And when you think about it, if you use the transitive property there with gender, a policy that creates inequitable outcomes between people of different genders would be sexism. And so I agree with this, and I think with sexual orientation, policies are things we can control. The human heart, not so much, but policies, right? So I think it's really important, physical ability, to make sure that our policies don't treat differently people who are disabled versus people who are not. And I was thinking at the heart of what he's saying ends up being empathy. All you have to do is think about what it's like for that other person. And my first thought was, because I was raised in the Midwest some time ago, on the golden rule, right? Treat others as you would have them do unto you. But that only works in a monoculture. In a monoculture, we all have the same goals, perhaps. But in a multicultural situation, that's just selfishness. You know, that's like if I was trying to explain this to my godchild. If I were at Christmas, using the golden rule, I would buy everyone a Chicago Bears sweater because I love the Chicago Bears and that's how I want to be treated. But someone may not like the Chicago Bears. They may not like football at all. So that doesn't work. I need to buy the Christmas present you want, not the one I want to give you. So Again, I think if we have a heart of empathy, it'll take us a long way down the road here. And I really appreciated this book for that reason. It got me thinking on that.
Yeah, you dipped your toe a little bit into emotional intelligence as well. So I look forward to continued conversations with you when you finish the book. I always enjoy those conversations with you, Scott. And so, and so as we wrap up, let me just ask everyone a question, and you can jump in where you jump in. Kendi believes we can defy the odds. And I love that about the book. He believes that we can defy the odds. He believes we can heal society of racism and create an anti-racist society. Do you believe that? Do either one of you believe that? And why do you think hope is so central to the anti-racist movement? Okay, let's start with Keitha.
Okay, well, the opposite of hope is despair. So I think hope is essential for what we need to do. And I do believe, yeah, there is hope that we can end racism. And it just it's going to be a group effort. It's not just one particular group that's going to be able to do it. We all have to do this together. I would love for my, I don't see this happening with my daughter, but maybe my grandkids someday and their kids and stuff. But I do believe that there is hope, and I think that we can all work together, and I can definitely see that happening.
James?
I do have hope, and I think, you know, that's what keeps us going. I have a new little great nephew, and when I look at pictures of him, I mean, I have to have hope that he's going to have wonderful opportunities and be able to pursue this American dream. So I do have hope.
Scott?
All I can say is I'm going to do my best to, in my life, at work and at home, to address these things when I need to and when I can. And I it's hard to think about the great big world because there's so much, you know, the news tells sometimes a pretty grim story, but it also, I feel like we're at a tipping point, and I want to keep pushing to get us over that. And I can't imagine what small part I can play, but I'm going to try. That's all I can say. I'm going to try.
I think all of you have played an important part today. We're doing something that needs to be done, and it's we can put a comma here, but we can't put a period here. We've got to keep talking. We've got to keep doing the things that we can do in the world that we live in. I think President Obama's book from a few years ago was called The Audacity of Hope. And we should have the audacity to hope. Our world is changing. And with the Scott Wilsons of the world and the Keitha Richardsons of the world and the James McKissicks of the world and so many others, I too am hopeful. And so let me thank each one of you for your participation in this Power of We panel discussion today. What you said is so vitally important and is rich to and for our community. And I also want to thank the listening audience and remind them to tune in next month for our final episode of the Perspectives on the Power of We. Scott Wilson of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee, James McKissick, Art Bild, and Keitha Richardson of EPB, Electric Power Board. Thank each one of you.
Now back to Perspectives on the Power of We with your host, Ron Harris and Warren E. Logan Jr., only on Groove 93.
Thanks for tuning in to the Perspectives on the Power of We, our new limited series brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee in partnership with the Urban League of Greater Chattanooga. Come back next week as Ron and Warren will discuss more perspectives on the Power of We. Tune in the last Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. on Groove 93.